Welcome to What's Left, a weekly political discussion challenging the mainstream left. I'm Eduardo Barco with Andy Lipson and our guest, Greg, on the part two of our series, our two-parter of Greg's journey and then now Greg and Andy's experience working together as comrades in the same union.
Correct.
So that is the second part that we've decided, as stated last week, that we were going to do. And I'm actually very interested in knowing how it is like working for both of you. Because both of you, how long have you been working together? I mean,
actually, like 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah.
I mean, but it's been...
Why does it feel like more? Maybe because we talk a lot.
I tell a lot of stories about it. In reality, this had been an episode that I've wanted to have for some time. That had I not had the experience or opportunities to organize with Greg, it would have just been like you talking with me about, okay, what's it like to be a kind of a lone socialist in a union or the worksite? Mm. But I'm very excited about the fact. I've been very glad about the work Greg and I have been able to do together, and really, this episode is the most important one to me. The previous episode was really just to introduce you. Mm. And I've really been looking forward to just talking about my thoughts, your thoughts, in relationship to some questions I know Eduardo had and we thought would be helpful for people who are trying to organize in their union, who think of themselves as revolutionaries. You may agree with what you hear from us. You may disagree. But these are just our thoughts. Mm-hmm. You want to say anything?
No, it's just great to be here. And I think that, what we're trying to do, be explicit socialists organizing in a union, is something that socialists need to be doing right now, wherever they are. I mean, for me, I think it's crisis shelter in place time, which means wherever you are, that's where your work is. Mm. And that's something that Andy's really helped hammer home for me over the last 2 years.
And I think it's true whether you're in a union or not.
Oh, yeah.
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 People are going to find that what we're talking about, the gains we've made, are extremely modest, mm-hmm. like just inches off the starting line. But I think thinking about what we're trying to do and being conscious of how we're trying to do it, I think, is what's been important for me, and having somebody to think it through.
Yeah. And you're saying, those gains are inches off the ground. I don't disagree with that assessment, but that's unprecedented in our workplace right now. Because the trajectory is usually the opposite direction.
Yes. Mm. Yeah.
And here on What's Left, we consider, we've been interviewing two different Bay Area teacher strikes, part of their union in Oakland,
right.
And then Los Angeles.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And San Francisco hasn't had a strike.
In 40 years, since 1979.
So I this is why we've...
Teachers union.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is why you and I decided to talk about your work and organizing, because it is something not just that you that we're just interviewing people and we're talking about. It's a personal issue to you as someone that hosts What's Left as well. Mm-hmm. So I think that I'm curious what your perspective is. I want to, just for our audience, because people don't know, UESF, which stands for United Educators of San Francisco, I wanted to just to state who they are, their belt, because I think it's important to get some context. And then after that, I will ask both of you your opinion about what their role or who they are and what's their experience like. The United Educators of San Francisco is the collective voice of San Francisco of unified school district teachers and paraprofessionals, organized and professional educators committed to learning and to the bond between students and teachers. As a union of professional educators, UESF has a responsibility to make an increasing effort to support successful education and seek remedies for unsuccessful educational efforts. UESF owes this responsibility to its members, its member students, and to the broader society. What unites these responsibilities is a commitment to optimize learning. Now, that's the stated, I got that from their website, their personal website. Do you both, what is that experience like working as just the union itself, it's as it, what do you think its role is? What do you think it's your experience within it? How has it been for both of you?
Who do you want to go first?
I can go, and okay. Then you can provide more context.
Okay.
Because I just started teaching in UESF 2 years ago. Came right out of grad school, knew I wanted to come to San Francisco. I'd been a communist for a long time, and I wanted to find, I mean, I finally got enough money saved up and was in a position in my life where I had rent control and I could go to graduate school. I actually got a settlement from a law enforcement agency that unlawfully arrested a bunch of us. It was a class action suit, and they gave me $3,500, and I put a down payment on a car. And so I like to say that the pigs sent me to grad school and tried to do the best good I could with that money. And so I got my credential, and I said, I'm going to go to San Francisco, become a union teacher, and try to work towards a strike and and try to make some gains, because my mother was a teacher, and she had a good long career and retired, you know, fairly comfortably in a way that this generation cannot. We're moving the wrong direction. And I had some long talks with her about it, and it was kind of clear to me that that was something that was worth doing. Oh, I did not know the level of degradation that the union has experienced in those 40 years. And early on, there was a vote to authorize a strike. And it was coming up, and it was in the middle of a bargaining process, and I was at Mission High. I was listening to Andy talk to some of his comrades in the building about that process, and I was pretty disturbed by what it sounded like the union's position was, but I still thought, oh, we're going to get a chance to vote to authorize a strike. And then the weekend prior to the vote was supposed to be on a Tuesday or a Wednesday, the weekend prior to the vote, on a late...
What year are you talking about, so we can get
this
some context?
This is 2017.
2017, yeah.
Yeah, contract year. And so we were actually working without a contract. They were just kind of extending the previous one. Mm-hmm. And the weekend prior to the first strike authorization, it's a two-part process, UESF sent out the celebratory email that they had reached an agreement in their closed bargaining session with San Francisco Unified School District. And so that first strike authorization vote at Lowell High School turned into a victory lap and a kind of PR session to push the new contract that we signed, which I think Annie and I would agree here was woefully inadequate and a major capitulation on a lot of the key demands brought by the union. But those demands were never really solicited from the rank and file by leadership. So they got to measure it against their own yardstick and say, hey, we won. And it was a major betrayal, kick in the gut. Suffice to say, I was asked to leave the meeting where that bargain was announced, and I was not the only person who was up in arms. And that was my introduction to UESF and how it really operates. And that's just a little context.
That was in 2017.
2017.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, and Greg had one round of that, and I've had
plenty.
8 rounds of that, basically. it's been the same story of union leadership saying they're pushing for a fight, threatening a strike of some sort, but really what they're doing is using the threat of a strike to reach the best agreement, best deal they can with the district. We haven't struck in the time that I've been there in 40 years. And I guess what I'll say, so that's bad. I mean, that's horrible, actually, because first of all, really the only reason a union exists is to strike. It doesn't exist to collectively bargain, I don't think. It doesn't exist to file grievances. It doesn't exist even just to have a contract. The primary reason workers get together as a group, as a collective in the workplace, is to strike and to withhold their labor so they can push their bosses to the wall. And the one thing to say is unions are not offensive bodies. They're defensive bodies. They're not meant to overthrow capitalism. They're meant to defend workers like muskox. circling each other to create the best defense they can in an entirely exploitative, oppressive system. So in that regard, I wouldn't expect unions to overturn capitalism, but I do expect unions to go on strike, and they haven't. And our leaders are part of that problem, but they're not the only part of it. Our members are also often reluctant to strike, and in many ways, one of the biggest problems I see in the union movement is that most people in our union, most members of our union, will say the union is our president or our vice president, and they'll think of the union as those people who do that office work, or sometimes they think of the union as the shop steward and the people who are the leaders at the site, but they don't think of the union as collectively themselves. Union leaders will tell members that, but they don't believe it, and we members don't act like that's what's really going on, and that has meant things are moving backwards more and more, more and more. So the union represents all those people, has all those people classified, certificated, paraprofessionals, teachers, counselors, librarians, security. It has all those people inside of it, roughly 6,500 people total. But those 6,500 people do not collectively see themselves as the union. And that is our biggest problem, one of our biggest problems.
Mm-hmm. You remind our listeners and viewers, how long have you taught at the mission, or for UESF?
This is my I'll be starting my 20th year.
20th year?
Yeah.
Okay. So that means then you, in all of this time, you've not experienced one strike, because you said it's before that time there was a strike for UESF, given the history.
Right.
And in that time, I was as well a member of the union, of the same union.
Yeah.
And I remember a time when we were, what was it? I forget the year. You were running as well to be a vice president. Mm-hmm. This was when Lita, should we mention her?
Sure.
Yeah. She's a public
figure. Yeah.
This is when Lita was running as well with you.
We were part of a reform caucus, Educators for Democratic Union.
Yes. Yeah. Can you tell our listeners what the caucus is? So there's several, right? Within the, there was
We were part of a reform caucus looking at the time, and we existed for about 8 years, 9 years, I think, to try to push the union to be more democratic, to be more activist-based, to push our union left.
Would you say your caucus was more radical than the others?
There were other caucuses
as well. I remember there were other caucuses.
I would say so, but we were ultimately, we were as much a failure as they were, because when we came to power, we got our president in, we did all the same old, same old. And now we're pretty much gone. So there was a big lesson for me about reform caucuses and whether they work out of that.
So you said you got the president.
Yeah.
Did you get other people?
We had a treasurer in, we had a secretary in, not vice president. And a lot of people thought that was like, and we didn't have a number of executive board seats. I know there are people who will say that's the reason it was a failure. That is not the reason. I'll just say that it took literally 2 days for us to go back. Like, our president took power in July 1, 2000. But on July 1st, by July 3rd.
What year was this?
I don't know. 2014 or 2015 or something like that. Yeah. But by July 1st. I'm just saying it's 2 days. 2 days for her and most of our caucus to go back on the idea of transparency. So it was a wrap, 2 days. So that project is not one, like, that was meaningful for me because it set me on a different path to think about what I'm trying to build in my work
site. Yeah. And I will just say, I admired Lita very much at the time, which is why I voted for her, for her to be president of the union.
And you got to experience Lita's presidency, which is where she basically backed out of the strike and went to Prop A, which was we're gonna charge
Prop
workers.
Was
it Prop G? A proposition, a tax proposition, basically that would
personal tax
give. Yeah, that would give
tax on homeowners.
Yes,
property.
Would tax other sets of workers in San Francisco so that we as workers could get a raise. Completely regressive.
The most recent one was Prop G.
Okay,
good. Well.
Do you want to say, because you want to say anything about your experience?
We're just talking UESF in general. and then we'll get down to UBC. But just in general, anything else you want to say?
Well, I think that there is no desire to solicit the voices or participation of new teachers or to educate them on their rights. It's very kind of service-oriented, and I think Annie can talk more about that. Union, where it's like, hey, we're going to pass you these financial consultants' information. You know, if you have a grievance, you know, send us an email. If you need t-shirts, you know, come pick them up at the union office. Things like that. There's a very arm's length attitude, and they have professional organizers, but those people don't communicate with the rank and file. Don't pick up rank and file interests or campaigns. They're referred to if you talk to like a high school area rep, representative, but what do they do? What are they working on? I don't know. I think it's very liberal in the pejorative sense. It is dedicated to, you know, incremental reform, electoral politics, and we are the ones in the know. We will handle this. We need to be a control on the vagaries of the mob. Basically, it's a microcosm of the United States the way it was founded. You know, this highly representative form of democracy where most of the energy of leadership is spent on trying to minimize the disruption caused by the rank and file or the citizenry in the case of the government. And I think that is something that is prevalent in a lot of unions, not just in ours.
And I might slightly disagree with that characterization, but let's talk about it here. Because I actually do think they'll try to educate the members, but from a top, we will educate you. We will tell you what you need to know. They will do every effort. Oh, we'll let you know about your contract. They will make that effort to do that. They will also have their representatives come in and try to work with people and help them individually, or sometimes, you know, so they will serve. They will provide a service as elected officials and as people who we pay their salaries. Okay. What they won't do is if any individual site, and this has happened several times, individual sites do their own organizing to make their situation like better and begin something started, getting something started, that's where they come in and put the kibosh on things. And they will say, oh, you're organizing outside of us because we represent the union. We represent the members who represent all the union. So whatever agreements you're reaching, you know, they're gonna somehow go outside of what we've agreed to. And I think this is one of the ways I've seen, in addition to putting the kibosh on any sort of strikes, every time any site has to try to do any independent organizing, they put the kibosh on that as well. And those are the major ways that I've seen them come in. And because I do think they work and they do try to do this educational work, but it's all top down. It's all the idea of we know something, you don't know something, we're going to help you learn it. We know how to do something, we'll help you do it in the relationship to like a grievance or to something you're dealing with. We'll give you that individual help. But in terms of actually helping or even inciting activism that it would go out beyond the control of the leaders, they would never do that. And when it gets that way, they come in and put a stop to it. That's how I kind of see their maybe.
Yeah, no, I'm yeah. Maybe my experience is colored by the fact that their attempts at education were so, well, there was a transition when I started, and we got a new representative who was trying to get up to speed in the year. But, you know, and that, I think that's part of the problem, though, is that they didn't really have a system in place for that transition, and he had to do his own training. And that's just not fair, but also as a new teacher, I felt like they dropped the ball in my year, but it's just more problems because they don't delegate and they don't empower people to do that education on site. They didn't reach out to a building, to our building, to do that. And I mean, if we're going to be a vital union, we have to be like a worm, where if you slice off a segment, it's going to be able to live on its own. Is that true about worms?
No, I'm not sure about that. Yeah.
But... Well, I want to believe.
I own worms as pets.
My
compost.
Right.
It's not true.
Okay. Well, then a chimera or whatever
right,
animal
right.
it is.
Yeah. Yeah, I know what you mean, though, right? Maybe a lizard's tail when you cut it, like, grows back. Yeah.
Right, right. But let's be...
I have a question for Greg, because I asked you what was the role of a union.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, Greg, what do you think is the role of a union, in your opinion?
Under capitalism, in this system?
Well, yeah, well, here, yeah, under this
system. That's a difficult question. It is what you make of it. I mean, I think that unions should be these organs that that socialists use right now to wage war against the capitalist system. I think that's what they should be. Mm-hmm. I think that they are a kind of transitional organ that protects workers so that workers can seize power. They're not that. I think that's what they should be. I don't know if that answers your question. That's aspirational.
It's your perspective. Yeah, I'm curious what you think the role of the union. Now I want to get into UBC, which is what I'm going to explain for our listeners and viewers. Within the UES, there's something called Union Building Committees, which is UBC. And I'm just going to read off their website what they mentioned the role of a UBC is. Union Building Committees are formed at individual work sites. For our audience, the role of the Union Building Committee and the building rep, which you two are, right? Have been. We'll get there.
We roll over into the next lecture.
Yeah. No, I'm just saying we played that role, yeah.
Right. Is the most important and influential representative body in the school. Equally recognized by administration and members, the UBC is a collective voice of teachers and paraprofessionals to ensure that UESF, the union members, are involved in the school-wide decision-making that affects their work lives and their students' education. The role of the UBC is to ensure that the rights that teachers and paraprofessionals have struggled for over time are not violated, and to enforce the contract. As the representative of the union at the worksite, the building rep plays an important role in every school. He or she is a member of the UESF assembly and the liaison to the UESF staff and leadership. The building rep also chairs the UBC, distributes union materials and information to members, and meets with the principal on a regular basis to solve problems at the school. Members of UESF vote on union building representatives at their individual worksite. My understanding is that you have been a UBC rep for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How long? You still are?
I picked it up again this last year. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. I leaned on him.
Yeah. All right. And then you're a UBC rep now?
Yes, we're co-reps at the site.
Oh, yeah. And I had, prior to Greg coming to Mission, I had played the role of being a building rep maybe for over a 10-year period or 11 or something like that. Maybe longer, but something along those lines.
So being a UBC rep is the direct relationship that one has from as workers in a school, in a work site, to the unions. You're really there to handle what the union cannot manage because it's obviously every school, you have so many teachers to keep up with.
We have 125 schools in the San Francisco Unified School District, yeah. And each one of them should have their own UBCs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What has... Because you both were elected, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What has been your experience working, like, as representatives at your work site?
Let me say something first.
Yeah.
Okay. First, I want to say that I do think, of all the things that are within UESF, and there's so many problems within UESF, the one structure that I think is a really good one is this UBC structure, this mm-hmm. idea of building a elected leader that attempts to represent all the workers at that site, mm-hmm. and the workers will be classified and certificated. That the classified are paraprofessionals, teachers' assistants, and security. There will also be counselors and librarians and teachers. There's wellness people as well. Those are called certificated. So that is a very. I feel like the potential for that is really, really good.
Yeah.
So that I'll start with. At that point,
you like it. Then.
I like that structure. It has not, unfortunately, operated with that kind of. It hasn't operated with that kind of democracy, largely because our members don't participate, mm-hmm. And they kind of see those people who do want the union, like who really are like excited about the union for the most part want the people who are elected to kind of be the union, which is what I would describe as that service model. And there's other sets of people who like, they don't really care less, or it's like, sometimes they even see the union as creating problems. And so the UBC is not able to, well, the building rep is not able to fulfill that role that I think they could, largely because of that. My feeling is the staff at my school, Mission High School, does not want two socialists running that's being the building representative.
This is
how
you're
experienced. What do you mean the staff?
I mean the teachers, paraprofessionals, that they, I believe that they don't want two radicals at the head of this thing, but that's what they've been stuck
at your work site.
At my work site.
All right.
Yes.
Yeah, because we're talking about your work site now.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's they're not a monochromatic.
Well, I'm just saying that is my
that
overall
is your experience.
Read. That's my overall
okay.
read.
Okay.
Not just experience, my assessment is that what socialists want to do is turn these bodies into bodies of warfare at the site and go beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's not. And they can only be sites of warfare if all of us engage in that struggle, and or the majority of us engage in that struggle. Andy can't go to war solo. Greg can't go to war solo. And I think, you know, so that is that's what we've been attempting to do. And I think a lot of our trouble in trying to do that and represent a fighting union, one that defends every single member that's under attack in that building, is due to the fact that a lot of members either don't believe in that vision, or they're uncomfortable with that vision, or it's like, I like it, but I don't know how we're going to do it, or something. You know,
I'm scared.
Yeah, afraid and not sure about what their own role would be in that. So that has, I feel like we're not the kind of leaders that our members actually want at our site.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the reasons that I stepped out, because I was like, even though I want to be an organizer, my members are asking me to operate with a service model.
He gets a read that most people are nuts.
Yeah.
What has been your experience
organizing?
What has
been your experience organizing?
He said our staff, and that's what I bridle at, because I think that if you do it for a long time and you deal with the apathy or the kind of opposition, it can wear on you. And I understand that and I empathize, because it fucking sucks. It sucked in the last year dealing with stubborn people who are hurting themselves and their coworkers out of fear, ignorance, or a lack of solidarity due to privileges that they might gain from being close to administration. So I understand where Andy's coming from. But we made progress this year, and we got people to agree to endorse or at least be open to a program of using our UBC as an organ for political activity, because we had a unique opportunity of two strikes that I used as leverage in the end of last year to convince Andy to, a la Danny Glover, come out of retirement, you know, for one last job. I think I'm mixing metaphors. If
That's
I did
fine.
The
yeah.
every time I'm out, they pull me back in. That would be a third
right.
unsuccessful film reference, but. Right. Anyway, I said, Andy was like, do you want to tell what you said last year when I went up to you and said, what's going to happen to UBC?
It's not going to exist, and the administration is going to run the show.
So I had...
And our members will get to experience what that feels like.
Yeah.
Because I think that's what they...
If what? It's not going to exist if what?
Oh, I wasn't going to be heading it up.
He wasn't going to do it. So I had a talk with Andy.
And the people who had previously done were stepping down. So I was like, oh, no union. Enjoy that.
Mm-hmm. So I had a talk with Andy and Darylin, and I said, listen, there's going to be possibly two major...
You're mentioning someone else, and I'm not sure if we should bring them in.
She's been here before.
Yeah.
All right. I'm always...
That's good. I like that that instinct. But and she's crucial to this discussion. I mean, she's really the one who kind of made that happen.
We interviewed Darylin for our viewers and listeners in another episode.
Yeah, check her out. She's
yep.
amazing. I mean, she's worked with my dad, I mentioned last episode,
mm-hmm.
on a lot of important stuff, and put her ass on the line, which is all you can do.
Mm-hmm.
So basically what happened was I told Andy, I came in for this stuff to mix it up. I don't want to wait. we have Oakland and LA possibly striking next year. We have to be organized in building. We have to be ready, not only to give possibly money, but ourselves for the picket lines, mm-hmm. and really bring that strike energy back to Mission, because after that, we're going to have our own contract up. And we can't let what happened in 2017, that big crushing disappointment of UESF leadership saying, fuck you, no strike vote. Who wouldn't want to go into a bargaining process with a 70, 80% strike authorization mm-hmm. on their back and say, look, we got our first step of our strike authorization going, so you better bump up our rates and stuff. No, UESF said they don't have the money. The leadership mm-hmm. said they don't have the money. We'd have to go to Sacramento, nothing we can do. But if you hold up a rich person and you shake them, guarantee they got some doubloons, you know, in their sock or something. It's going to fall out, right? And we found out later, yeah, there was more money. Mm-hmm. And in fact, from some kind of unexpected allies, a lot of people are upset about the way our schools are funded. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so what happened was I said, we cannot go into next year without a building. And I
building rep.
A building rep. Sorry, building union, UBC. Mm-hmm. And so I said, I'll do it. And I'm scared because I don't have tenure and I think they're going to go after me. And that's the only reason why I wouldn't do it, because if I get neutralized, then it was kind of a waste of time. Yeah. So Darylin pipes up and says, hey, I did it my second year. We didn't have a building. I stood for the building representative and, I will help you if anything happens. Flash forward, they went after me.
Darylin, who went after you?
The administration was working with the district to try to get me out after a year of kind of activist UBC mm-hmm. leadership. And
which they deny, but I think they're lying. So,
well, yeah.
Yeah, they tried to put him on non-reelect, and they said they didn't put him on non-reelect, which basically says you're fired for no cause.
And then you have to change careers, like, mm-hmm. or you can go teach in another district.
Right.
But they didn't have reasons, and they don't have to give a reason.
They're supposed to not give a reason.
It would be something to look at for the next contract bargaining if our union had teeth. Yeah. So anyway, she helped me, documented everything, sat in with me on these meetings, and
so you were on the list, but you weren't given the non-reelect.
No, but I was in an evaluation process beforehand that was really unfair.
Yeah.
Where the times were being changed, the reviewer was trying to change the parameters. They were trying to focus on a specific period that I had explicitly been told would not be visited again, so they could get a broader range of my teaching practice. The whole thing was a mess.
They were looking. It really looked like they were trying to set him up.
Yeah, and so what Andy convinced me to do, and I was scared to do it, was put it all on blast. We published all the documents. We showed people what was going on. We just put it under a microscope.
And how did you do so? Shared email?
Yeah, we sent out emails to the entire staff, and summaries, and we had meetings that we transcribed and sent out, and administration retreated. And they took my name off the non-reelect list, but not quickly enough, because I heard from the union, the high school representative, that your name's on the list. And then the principal, when I got a hold of him, said, oh, no, you're not, but it was too late. We let everybody know. We had a special meeting. It was the biggest attendance that we've had. The room was packed and people were really alarmed. And so when Andy says our union doesn't want an activist, our teachers don't want an activist, I think he's mostly right, but I think that could be changing. And I think I can't credit myself. I think I really credit LA and Oakland, but I think that our UBC and the people we work with in our UBC, there's about four or five people who form a core group. I think we're really instrumental in bringing that energy into the room. So anyway, our worst case scenario came to pass, but we got through it because Darylin knew what was going to happen and said she would fight it. And so we had a building rep, and Andy said, you're young, you're learning how to teach, you're learning the ropes of this, I'm going to do the grunt work. And he's been amazing at doing the... a lot of the nitty-gritty stuff of it and using his expertise, but really letting me be the face and the voice and do some thinking and learning and maybe a little fumbling and growing in the process. Because I think he understands that, you know, it can't just be one of us. There's got to be many of us. And what a union activist must do is create more, like pod people, you know? Just like infect as many people as you can with class consciousness and a sense of urgency that you're not going to do anything effective on a broader level if you don't start right where you are. That's what I learned from him. And that made our year, I think, a little more successful than if it had just been me or, mm-hmm. you know, no mm-hmm. one.
But let's be clear, when we were elected ultimately, we didn't have anybody running against us. We didn't have an oppositional building rep, not oppositional. We didn't have an alternative set of building reps with a different vision of how that union should run.
Yeah.
The UBC should be run.
How the UBC could be run. Because yeah. I do think there are different ways to run a UBC than the way two revolutionary socialists would try to run a UBC. And I think if our members were given all those alternatives, they wouldn't necessarily choose two revolutionary socialists to be heading up their union. But he is right that by us working together and us getting through some fires together and the experience of going to LA and going to Oakland or providing solidarity, mostly
with LA, yeah.
financial solidarity for LA, but really going to Oakland and joining them on the picket line, that has had an impact on at least a segment of people.
You were in communication with striking LA teachers and you did a great job of relaying that to the building. So yeah. Yes, we weren't there physically, but I feel like we got a sense of what was going on.
And our many members from our site provided direct financial support to raise money to do strike support for them. So that's not a small thing. Oakland...
That's how you got in touch with Claire, by the way.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And in Oakland, where there was an opportunity to go on the picket lines, a smaller set of us went to the picket lines. Mm-hmm. But I think it was meaningful for people to see that. Certainly it was transformative for me to see the types of changes that members would go through by being on strike. Mm-hmm. And it has only confirmed for me that we must go on strike. And the longer we don't, the more our union atrophies.
On strike for what, Andy?
Anything.
Right. There was a break.
Sorry. Right. So you asked...
I was asking you, what you were saying a strike.
Right.
You were talking about a strike.
Right.
And I was telling you, well, a strike for what?
Right.
Right. What is a strike demanding for?
Right. So in general, people are familiar with education unions asking for better wages.
Right.
Calling for smaller class sizes.
Right.
Calling for more hours for paraprofessionals or better wages for paraprofessionals. More counselors, more supports for students with special needs or English as second language. All those things are good. All those things are worth striking for.
Social workers.
Yes, yeah. To improve public education under capitalism. Yeah. That is why workers, that's why we all these strikes have been talking about some version of that.
But as a socialist,
right.
What is a strike? And I was asking you,
right.
Beyond that,
right.
What is a strike? Right. As a socialist, what are you demanding for?
Right. So for me as a socialist, I want a strike because I want that strike to lead to a bigger strike. I want solidarity strikes to join it. I want our strike in San Francisco to turn into a Bay Area general strike or Oakland joining us and then California, Sacramento joining us, San Diego. As public educators, I want that strike to expand. I want other workers from other sectors to join in that same strike that teachers are going. So my reasons for striking as a socialist aren't really about let's just change this or that contract. My reason is I want to build a larger general strike here throughout California that would then build workers' councils in order to manage and organize those strikes, and that those new councils would lead to an insurrection that would take power and make a revolution take place in this country. Like, my reason for striking is as steps towards socialist revolution, not towards steps towards changing a contract. I want to change workers through the process of them fighting for their own liberation. And that's why I want to strike, which is why, you know, I would always vote no for every strike, like for every contract. That is, I'll vote yes on the strike, but like if they say, oh, we'll give you 100% pay increase, I'm voting no. Oh, we're going to make your class size go 15-1, I'm voting no, because I want the strike to expand. Mm-hmm. And well, that's my
20%,
goal.
You want, and they say 11, we'll give you 11%, I vote no.
Vote for sure on that, but and if they meet our demands, I would say we didn't make big enough demands. The demands of our strike need to be to get rid of capitalism ultimately.
Be unreasonable.
Right. It can't be just the pragmatic, because this system doesn't work. It doesn't work for workers, and workers need to change it. And workers need to transform it, and smash it. And the way they do that is by striking. And that's the starting point. That's the first steps they have to take. And until they take those steps, we're not going to get anywhere.
You think this is the genesis for a revolution?
Yes. A strike is the early steps, even if workers don't see it that way, I do think they're the early steps towards making a revolution. Towards workers collectively recognizing their power that they have only collectively. They don't just have it individually. And for them using that power to control and put pressure on the capitalists. If that power was harnessed strongly enough, it wouldn't just put pressure, it would push them off the stage of history.
And by solidarity strikes, you don't mean other teacher unions only. You mean other workers.
Other workers, right. Unionized or not unionized, right?
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. Greg, do you want to add or say something about that? Just what do you see a strike is for? What is the role of a strike within a union, I think?
Yeah, I agree with the shape of Andy's answer. I think that the working class, as it stands right now, is not in a condition to have that kind of cascading effect where it becomes a regional, statewide, national, hopefully international strike. But I think that we need to push that position. I feel like so many leftists are in love with pragmatism and saying, what's reasonable? What's a win we can promise and deliver on?
Yeah.
And I think the job of the activist is to say, what is the ultimate goal? What must be done, right? So that we can win, so that we can have lasting gains. Because every single gain that we make within this system, within the capitalist system, is another kick when you're treading water, keeping your nose above the level of the water for just a few more seconds. We're drowning. Workers are drowning. We're being murdered. We're having our heads held under by monsters who want to grind our bones for bread. Like, we are nothing but cattle to the capitalist class. We're cows. They don't give a damn about us. Look at the healthcare system. Look at our wars of aggression throughout the world. They don't give a fuck about workers. They don't give a damn about public schools. And people like Betsy DeVos and her ilk, who are pushing the whole privatization aspect, make it clear. But they are one face of the Janus with the Democratic Party that is, Obama, Arne Duncan, big-time voucher, big-time charter school guy. Charter schools have a great sound to them when you think about community engagement, letting parents have a say. Oh, that's fantastic. You know what you can't have? Profiteering companies that come in and say, you know what, every head of kid, we're going to get this X amount of money. We're going to get paid like this. We're going to handpick the kids who don't have individual educational plans like IEPs. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We're going to pick the kids who can get high test scores and get us, you know, looking better, paid more. So I really see it as Andy's right. I just think that the experience of this strike, hopefully that we have coming up, will be one of radicalization. It'll be a win. It won't be the win that it could be. And if it is, I'd be so happy for that. I would love to work towards that goal. But anyway, even if it falls short of those lofty ideals, I'm voting no. And I'm going to encourage other people to vote no. Because as with a presidential election or something like that, everybody says, well, I'm going to be pragmatic. I'm going to vote for Hillary this time. I don't like her. She's a warmonger. She's horrible. But come on, Donald Trump. Listen, folks. So many people are in that big middle of that bell curve saying the same damn thing. If you had the courage of your convictions and said, fuck Hillary Clinton. She's an imperialist pig. I'm not voting for her either. She wouldn't have even gotten nominated. You know, not that the Democrats didn't pull dirty tricks. They did. But what did Sanders think would happen? He ran in the Democratic Party. I mean, he knows what they're like, you know? So anyway, my point is I'm on board with Andy's plan. And even if we fall short of what Andy's predicting, we'll be ready for the next time. In every strike is the potential for galvanization of at least a sector of the working class. And that's something to work for and celebrate.
And I share Greg's assessment of our class. That is, that even though I say that's what I want our strike to ultimately be about and to be the initiator for, I do know that that is a very unlikely thing. But because that is our goal, we are the ones who have to speak to that goal. And I believe we are speaking as to the rest of our working class that we're in contact with and saying, this needs to be our goal. If you want to see the kinds of changes that you say you want to fight racism and end racism, you want to end sexism, you want to end that kind of oppression, we will not be able to end it unless we take down capitalism. And we will need to overcome some of these divisions that exist within the working class in order to do that. So I agree with Griggs. I have a very pessimistic view about where our working class is at. But even if people don't come to those revolutionary conclusions through the strike, this is where the working class learns.
Yeah.
It is the only place that it learns. It doesn't learn through elections. It doesn't learn through watching other people do things.
Mm-hmm.
It learns through its own experience.
Yeah.
And some of these things we're going to learn are like, oh shit, we have so many divisions that we scab on each other. Or we have people who, we're not armed. We need to be armed. You know, there's going to be all sorts of lessons we're going to learn that we don't necessarily want to learn,
yeah.
But we need to learn them if we're going to improve, if we're going to become capable as a class of fighting for ourselves and taking the system down and replacing it with something else.
Absolutely. I wanted to add one thing. Sorry, Eduardo. Just when he says that, let us remember that our union leadership may have come from people who believe the same thing as Andy. They may have started their careers or even to this day feel like we need a workers' party, we need a dictatorship, the proletariat, we need to have a revolution. Strikes are a method to that. But if you are trying to cover yourself in respectableness and seem pragmatic and play act as a leader, that is not the role of a socialist or a revolutionary. You have to you have to push the conversation, shift the window over towards your revolutionary position. Too many people privately will say, I agree with you. And then publicly say, let's vote yes. They gave us everything we wanted. I'm talking specifically about people in OEA, the Oakland Educator Association, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. it could be any union.
Because that happened in our union as well.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. But specifically happened in OEA, and I'm like, what the fuck? Anyway, so I just think what Andy's saying is right, and the people need to listen to it. If you are still playing the game of respectability, then we are doomed as a class, because if you know the truth about capitalism and you know the truth about the system and you're still, you know, imagining this kind of grand compromise type position for yourself as a leader in the movement, we've lost.
Now, you said that you have a read at your work site that they don't want two socialists representing them. Is that a feeling?
If I was to put money down on it, I would say they ultimately are looking for a different sort. Yeah, they want people to defend them individually and things like that. But in terms of the kind of vision we're articulating here of using organizing workers as a tool for battling the capitalists and being prepared to lead that, they're like, whoa, no. We didn't sign on for that, Andy.
What do you mean? Why do you say that?
We have not been even unable to organize. There are people who have felt attacked by our administration, and we've pointed those things out, and our fellow workers are like, that's their problem. Mm. I mean, if you are not willing to do injury to one is an injury to all, you are not willing to go forward into the kinds of world we're talking about, because that is the basis of it. That's the basis of basically strikes they just deported 600 people, right? Mm-hmm. Or they just threatened people, 600
no,
people.
No, they're deporting.
Deporting them, right. There should be... The way you're going to stop that as a working class is you just got our brothers and sisters there. We're shutting the system down. We're shutting these workplaces down. That's how you do it. So that injury to them is an injury to us because that's our fellow workers. So you continue to run these prisons like essentially slave galleys, you know, without being on ships. Unless you empty those prisons out, we're shutting your system down. That's how it's going to work. So if you don't believe an injury to one is an injury at all, then you can't be fighting for that socialist revolution. Because it's predicated on the notion of none of us, all of us together win. Mm-hmm. And if they try to pick off any small one of us, that's the very division they're going to use to bring our movement down. Mm-hmm. We can't have any of those divisions. And the extent to which we do allow it is the extent to which we will be unsuccessful in challenging the capitalists.
Mm-hmm. And it's not fantasy. I spoke up. I was active. I was building rep, and I was critical of administration. And they tried to end my career in San Francisco. I'm a second-generation teacher, San Francisco native, very passionate about what I do. And it doesn't matter. If you make waves that could be harmful, they will retaliate. And it's not. I mean, I understand. I don't have children. I have rent control. I'm not quite as precarious as some other people might be. And so it's a risk I was willing to take. I'm also powered by the fires of pure ideology, right? But I understand why people are afraid. They're afraid of the minute that you stick your head out the side of the train, you know, they can pick you off, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they can get you. And I understand the fear. And I think a lot of it is fear.
And the hope that there might be an easier way, that we can elect some Democrats.
Sanders.
We could get Sanders to do it. It'll be the hope that there might be an easier way than just doing that. And that hope is a dangerous hope in my mind. And it creates a fantasy that keeps us from doing the only thing. It's a hard thing. I believe it is a hard thing, but it is the only life worth living is the life of all of us workers trying to figure out how to actually work together to overturn the system. That I can't see anything better to do than that. Like, not in terms of there's not like what more glorious thing to do other than joining with all the rest of the oppressed working class across the world and figuring out how to take down all of our respective bosses. Mm-hmm. That's the best, you know. But it's also very hard, and it's very frightening to think about doing that. And people are looking for shortcuts, and those shortcuts are fantasies and illusions that keep us. That is part of keeping us from taking up this battle.
I'm going to ask a quick question. Do you think some of the identity politics and the liberal way of thinking has infiltrated? And potentially stopped the unity or the harmony with you all.
You wanted me to do first, or you?
Go ahead.
It is that is a political challenge. Identity politics are not revolutionary politics, and they are politics that they are a response to oppression. All right, they're a response to the racism that people are experiencing and sexism, but they're not a revolutionary answer to that problem. And so, yes, just like Bernie Sanders is not a revolutionary answer to that problem. It's fool's gold. It looks like it might be a solution, but it's not. And so in that regard, identity politics is as counterposed to uniting the working class, white workers, black workers, male workers, female workers, Muslim workers, immigrant workers, native workers, under one banner of taking down our respective capitalist classes. Yes, identity politics doesn't set about organizing the working class on all these different gender, sexual orientation, national bases. That is the project of socialists, and only the project of communists or socialists, not the projects of people who are fighting this system through the lens of identity politics.
I mean, the way that I have communicated it to Andy before is it's like you're on the Titanic and it's going down. You hit an iceberg and everybody in steerage, you're like, all right, guys, now's our chance. Let's go up into the ballroom and eat all the steak and lobster. Let's have a good time. Well, the problem with that is that the ship is sinking. Capitalism is doomed. And I think that short-term gains, in the name of women in women CEOs or trans drone pilots or African American prison guards or whatever the case may be, those are gains that serve to support the existing system and the framework of success. Is within the parameters of acceptable discourse. And it's not revolutionary, as Andy said, and it's not a recipe for success. I don't like the term identity politics like that, because I think that identity politics themselves are value neutral. I think that having your identity inform your politics is fine. I think it's liberal identity politics are the problem. Because if you come to the conclusion, and we can, it's just a definitional thing, but you can have, you can engage in identity politics in a revolutionary way. You could have a revolutionary case for reparations. If your goal is attacking the state and redressing things like genocide and slavery in a meaningful way and making sure that the current incarnations of those are abolished, I think that you could definitely have a radical revolutionary program built around that idea. Mm-hmm. And I think that the issue is it's not often that. What dominates in the discourse in our school and in teachers as a kind of petit bourgeois, you know, professional class. Are we working class? Are we something more? We do have an extra degree, you know, that kind of attitude. What you see is, I think, cynicism and people saying, we're never going to have a revolution. I've struggled. I've faced a lot of discrimination in my life. These kids are being discriminated against. We need to do what's best in the now that's reasonable. And the parameters of what's reasonable are so narrow in the confines of the current education system. It's a betrayal of the workers and betrayal of the students and the communities those students come from. But for some people, it's all they can imagine. And for others, it's this kind of cynical idea that it's never going to happen. So fuck it. Let's just shelter in place. Let's just grab the steak off the banquet, off the banquet table as we go down. I mean, the challenge is to counter that and to open it up and say, if you care about justice and you care about democracy, then you have to destroy capitalism because there will always be this wedge, this division among the working class perpetuated by capitalists based on race, religion, gender. These are very useful vectors for the ruling class to use to divide workers. And an organized working class can get around those divisions in a meaningful way. But if we allow them to control that narrative, the bosses to control the narrative, we're going to be at each other's throats fighting over scraps because they will bus a bunch of undocumented immigrants to a hotel to staff it while the hotel workers are out on strike because they want you to go after them with bats. Mm-hmm. They want, yeah.
I have a question for you, Greg.
And just to be clear, just like he and I don't agree on, say, the participation in DSA, we have a different vision of how to talk about identity politics. Like, you know, we don't necessarily agree on that stuff.
I think our difference is definitional, but maybe it's beyond that.
I think it's bigger, but...
I have a question for you, Greg, because you said something I was going to ask you about identity politics, just so you can expand and deepen what you're saying, because I'm a little... When you said that identity politics within a revolutionary change right. can still be used, such as for reparations, can you expand on what you mean?
Well, sure. I mean, I was radicalized in large part by my mother, whose politics were informed by her experience as a brown woman in San Francisco, entering into institutions and then into teaching and experiencing racism and gender discrimination. And her takeaway from that was all workers need respect. And you can't, like, singling out people for who they are is wrong. And she had another takeaway. It was that white people can be fucked up and not to be trusted. And am I going to tell her that's wrong? What she is noticing is the existence within a kind of subsection of the working class of a certain group being facing less consequences and fewer consequences. Sorry, I'm an English teacher. And so she grew up wary of white educators, and she developed a sense of pride in being Chicana and being a woman, and that I thought was that I think was very healthy and helpful for her political development, because I saw her brothers go the other way. She has brothers who are, you know, Trump or kind of like libertarian type of political people who don't even consider themselves Chicano or Mexican American anymore. Would not even acknowledge really that part of their heritage.
So you're a socialist, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying that under socialism, then you would still keep identity politics?
I just think it's inextricable. I think people are going to view everything through the frame of their identities. And the point is, as a socialist, is to foster solidarity across identitarian lines and try to build a unified working class that can overthrow the capitalists and make the case that the only way to destroy racism, sexism, and other forms of bigotry forever in a lasting way is by abolishing the capitalist system and educating every generation through a cultural, social revolution that we have been conditioned to hate and fear and be xenophobic, and that that's merely conditioning, cynical conditioning from a ruling class that must be unlearned. Mm-hmm. And I believe we can get there. I believe we have to get there. I don't really understand. I don't understand... what identity politics has become as a term, because I just don't, I think I know what liberal politics are, and I would say the problematic identity politics are just liberal politics where people focus on representation and, you know, signifiers and saying the right thing and trying to expiate their own guilt or try to use their own identity in a way to win an argument or to gain some advantage or to make people feel guilty for, you know, some reason. Yeah, that's terrible. That's awful. But the truth of oppression is real, that racism was really something that was fostered by the capitalist class to justify mass exploitation of certain types of workers and to avoid or to find a way to obstruct solidarity from the working class of Europe to the people putting themselves in harm's way to harvest certain crops like sugarcane or harvest certain crops like cotton and enrich the ruling class. So you create a kind of a higher level of consumer class over the exploited workers. What's an easy way to do that so that you don't have solidarity between those who are exploited and those who are marginally less exploited? Well, you foster this kind of bigotry.
And under socialism, those things would be taken up. The identity politics that was used under capitalism to divide workers, under socialism, that wouldn't be there anymore. Yet you're saying that it would still be necessary to retain. Is that it?
I'm not sure. I don't think I said that. I think what I said is that it's going to take a while to heal the wounds that have been
fostered. You're saying like a transition
by the capitalist class. Yeah, I don't know how long it's going to take, but I know that, and I work with children, and I have young children in my life, and I don't think there's anything inherent about racism, xenophobia. I think these are learned attributes, and I think a problem with a lot of liberal identity politics is that they try to make it so that racism is this big mystic thing. Like, racism is something that is always with us, and it's something that is kind of innate, and I think that that is not true, and it's something that can be unlearned, but it can only be unlearned and destroyed through the abolition of the capitalist system.
That was
really long.
That's no, fine. It's good. You will have.
We had our say about identity politics.
You will have plenty to say.
We'd have to do another episode on that. I don't want Andy to cut it.
I won't cut it because I think.
Please.
I'm
not good at editing myself.
Yeah, I won't. I will only edit things that if you thought it was. Yeah, I mean, and I wouldn't think we have to. I think it's another. Again, I don't agree with it because I think it's a backdoor.
What do you disagree with?
That there's no form of revolutionary identity politics. There isn't. That might be a.
No, but what I said, like, that, what part of it was the part that?
That you... is that there's liberal identity politics, and then there's some sort of revolutionary version.
No, but people view every situation through the prism of their identity.
I understand, but that, well, not everyone does, but I think that that is the dominant. But
everyone does. They have a story or a narrative about who they are.
But that has not, whether they have a story or not, that doesn't constitute a plan for revolution or even an outlook on how we're going to have a revolution.
You can have a story. It informs the way that they look at it. Like, but the primary one is their class position.
I'm just saying that if you look at it through the lens of identity politics, not I have an identity. I'm not saying, but the idea that your identity is a basis for organizing yourselves around other people who have to share that identity. That's what identity politics are. They're not just liberal. They're not just a liberal identity politics. Because I do think we have differences. That's all I want to say. We have differences.
I get why people organize themselves around identity like that.
So I would just say it's like, it is what it is. You know, and that's why you were kind of questioning it, because you had heard something different from me and you were...
Well, because I don't actually know your position.
Yeah.
And I already know Andy, so...
And I think the audience is going to hear something in it that is going to be like, they may relate to it. They don't agree with it.
We just both agree the Zapatistas are wrong. So right. As long as you know that.
So, anyway.
Yeah, well, let's go back to how we got into this other hole. At work, and at least here in San Francisco, the position of liberal progressive politics overtake the discourse.
Dominate, yes.
Yes, dominate. Yeah. What is it like for, that's what I was asking you both, really to explore or expand on that that experience of yours working in that pool.
Well, it's been an eye-opener for me because I wasn't really... I was raised with people who are very critical of the system as it is, and not inherent gobblers of kind of the gospel of whiteness, which is an it's an assimilating force. Mm. You know, whiteness is something that kind of like, we're going to take Italians, we'll take Irish, we'll take the Jews, we're going to take Christian Arabs. You know, it's just, it recruits the minute it feels under stress. Mm. And now you're seeing a lot of European, Latino people of European descent assimilated into whiteness, especially in California. It's just curious to watch that happen. Anyway, I was raised very critical of that identity. Never really identified with it. But in the context of the building that we work in, I'm white. I'm a white man. My mom was Mexican-American from the mission? Doesn't matter. That's not important. You're a white man, and you're speaking, and you're taking up space. And that's a very confounding thing to experience, especially if you're if you're advocating for people of color, and you're holding space for people who are traditionally silenced. And you're trying to give them a platform, not because you sought them out as a token, but because that's who's coming to you. And it's a very odd thing to be kind of affixed with the label of racist. And I think that we can agree this is when identity politics get very pernicious, is when they are in service of power and existing power dynamics. And the weaponization of liberal identity politics within the kind of context of our workplace and the teaching profession as a whole is something that almost always serves administration, serves the district, is something weaponized to foster kind of cracks in solidarity and destroy broader movements among educators, between educators and students, and go from a solidarity model to a guilt model. So what you see is a lot of white teachers or male teachers or whoever the identity is being called out, operating out of guilt and shame, which is a losing proposition. The minute that you feel like you're doing people a favor, there's no solidarity there. You're being paternalistic. Or the minute you feel you're operating out of guilt, there's no solidarity there. You are a service provider. You're somebody who's redressing a past ill, and you can't have a real relationship. And I think that natural, wonderful humanity breaks through that bullshit dynamic. But unfortunately, if that is how you approach teaching or administrating, Your project is going to be liberal, ineffectual, reformist, and counter-revolutionary. And I have seen that in our space, and I'm not giving up the fight, but what you really have to do is your work. You got to do your work, show up, practice what you preach, and not let those arguments derail your project.
Seven, 8 minutes.
I would say that the first off, it's very difficult to try to try to keep your eyes on the prize of socialist revolution, of taking down capitalism, of the trying to establish the dictatorship of the proletariat, workers' councils, general strikes leading to insurrection. It is very difficult to keep your eyes on that prize when everything around you is reformism and is reformist. And not just the people who think of themselves as being part of the Democratic Party who might acknowledge, I'm a reformist, but I want progressive change. But the revolutionaries, everyone who calls themselves revolutionaries have been reformists and operating like reformists, operating within pragmatism. That includes myself. I was a founder of Educators of Democratic Union, one of the six founding members of that project. And I think that was a big mistake. I think it was me as a revolutionary trying to build a reformist transitional.
You're talking about the caucus.
The caucus, yeah. And that was a mistake. And that's only 10 years ago that I was doing that. Today, there's only one thing I want to build. I want to build a socialist cell at my school. Greg, be part of it. I want anybody else I can include who is a conscious revolutionary, who wants to organize as a revolutionary within our school and see where we can take it from there. I'm not interested in building reform this and reform that, which is something that was a project I was on. It's a project that many revolutionaries are currently on to build reform caucuses and things. And I think I get it, but it's a mistake. We are doing it because we are swimming in a reformist sea, and we have no North Star that we think of to guide us to how to act as revolutionaries in our situation of deep isolation and deep distance from the revolutionary tradition, and a revolutionary tradition which seemingly has produced only gulags and other imperialist empires and one-party states that seem dictatorial. All right, so that is not.
Another podcast.
All right. But that is not what people are signing on for when they sign up for revolution. They're not signing on for North Korea or Soviet Union as it was under Stalinism or Cuba. They're not. I think what they want to sign on is for liberation of humanity and an international, like the working class running things democratically. I believe people would say, yeah, that's what I want, you know, but they don't see how we can get there. And I think many of us revolutionaries have given up on the project. And for me, part of this podcast is trying to reclaim a voice for articulating that vision, which is why some people would say, oh, you sound extreme, you sound ultra, blah, 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 right? Because I'm just saying what are basics of revolutionary thought. They are, you know? It's just that seems so far off. Why should you say it? Well, we're never going to get there unless someone says it.
There you go.
So... that has been a very challenging thing to do, and yet you have to do that. You have to be in the workplace every day. I think it's good that people go out and do street fighting with, you know, fighting with the cops and that, a protest and like that. I think that's the kind of stuff people do kind of have to do. What we're seeing in among the yellow vests in France, but the real work we have to do ultimately is figuring out how to be day to day revolutionary under conditions where management is chipping away at you, where your own colleagues are kind of have different visions of what kind of change, and they sort of say, no, that's not possible. We don't think it's possible. Maybe you should change your mind. How do you get through that wear and tear, the daily drip of reformism, of you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't say that, that's too much? How do you keep yourself whole and build something out of that? And I think it's very hard. And I think it's, you know, some people have to put up with like, you know, saying radical things and risking getting shot. Some people have to say radical things and risk getting put in jail. I think if you say radical things in this country, what you really risk is isolation. And that is a very difficult thing to experience. But you have to be prepared for that isolation and prepared to say what you mean and look to see if you can find allies that, even though we don't agree on everything about socialism, I do believe we agree with about revolution, and I do believe we think the working class is the agent of change, and I do see we see a project that we can be on at our workplace around that and learn something out of that. So we're going to learn. That is what is most important about what, for me, what me and Greg are doing, is learning out of that experience. Because while both of us agree with putting forward this kind of extreme position, it is really us kind of saying, we've seen people do it another way, we're going to try it this way. It's not like we can prove that this is going to work, but this is what we're, this is our bid to try to do something different, as I see it.
This is the reason why I will say, Andy, that you are, I know two other UBC reps, and they are two other socialists, different. They joined a party, and one of them is Natalie. And out of all the staff, everyone always says that that you all are, I hear from Mission, but you, I hear from them at their worksite, the staff say that you all are very good at organizing, because the vision is clear. There is a larger movement outside of the union, outside of work, for una revolución. So it's that intention, that so intentional focus gives you all that organizing power at work, which makes people use you all for the grievances, for the, for all these other things. Oh, go sick them, the administration, because they know that you will put your body on the line.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I know that that's what they use Natalie for. They constantly put her in the office. I want her to represent me. I want her to be the witness.
Right.
Because constantly they're organizing. This is beyond just, I'm going to reform the school. It's, I'm trying to create solidarity districts here. So this is my job. This is my work. This is my life's work. What do you see then? What's next for you both? Working together, and what's next for you both in the union, specifically at your work site?
Who first?
At the work site, we got to have elections and make sure that those elections, if we win, are a mandate for us to continue our activist activities. And if we lose, that we kind of find a new way to do our work where we're not kind of acting like we're speaking for a larger body. I think Andy would agree. We want, if we're going to continue as building reps, we want buy-in and legitimacy. And if we get that, people are going to fall off, but maybe we'll have a bigger core of activists. Right now, I'd say we're at like 4 or 5. And that's what we want. We want to grow our activist base. And if we're really not wanted by our staff, I think we're both believers in, I wouldn't even call it democracy. I would just call it like consensus, like that people who are agreeing go forward together. If there's not enough agreement, and we
to
have
to keep
to keep us in our role.
As elected
EDC then we need to find a different way. And I'm okay with either eventuality. The ultimate goal doesn't change, but then I get to be the you know, the rock thrower from outside, which is a position I'm more comfortable with. And that could be effective too, because you can attract people to you when you're out of power. You can present a different line that can bring people down towards you. But you know, either way, it's going to be a lot of work, but it's the only real work that matters. Teaching is great, and I think that work really matters. But if you're not fighting for an end to the system that oppresses you and your students and your coworkers and the staff in your building, then you're part of the problem. And I hate to say it, and it's a realization that might drive a lot of teachers nuts, but what we're doing is not that important if we're not fighting for socialism. If we're not fighting for economic justice, you can educate kids all you want. They could be the kids that go on to conquer Iran and destroy, you know, another culture in the name of U.S. empire. And that's not justice, and that's not doing the kids a service. So if your practice of teaching is not coupled with socialism, you got to reevaluate it.
It's hard to say.
Hard to say? Hard to hear, maybe.
Hard to hear, to say. I think a lot of teachers would disagree immediately.
Yeah.
It's not coupled when you say that.
Yeah. And that's why we are where we are in 2019.
I agree with what Greg's saying there. My starting point is to continue to work with Greg in trying to find a vision of how to be revolutionaries within our site, within our union. Obviously, this is a contract year, so we're going to try to like do whatever we can to build for a strike. But Greg is right that the immediate thing in front of us, I do think, and I really hope for the first time we have genuine elections at our site. I think it is democratic. I don't believe in consensus as a means of organizing workers. I think it is democracy, and it will be. Will an alternative leadership emerge within our site that has a different vision of how to run the union at our site that is different than Greg's and mine? And will members get to have that choice to say we want that versus this versus that? That's what I want for our members and for our class, so that they can vote for that, they can follow that, and they can see what results it produces. I believe that we are best fit to lead our workers for not just a contract, but in the direction of greater social change, taking on capitalism and fighting for socialism. We are very inexperienced at this thing, but at least we have a vision of that sort of thing. So I believe we are people who, if you want that, then you should elect us, you know? And if you have a bigger vision of social change than just like changing your contract, but using the workplace and the workforce to make much bigger change, I think you'd want us. But if you have a different vision of how the workplace should run and how a union should run, you should not vote for us. You should vote, and hopefully you get a choice. And that's why I think our biggest thing is providing, hopefully, that opportunity. Because I do think there are the divisions that exist within our workplace, I think, opened up in ways that were more vocal and more open last year. And that was a result of our work, of us pushing hard one way. And many of our members were like, F that. We don't want that. What are you doing? And they spoke out against it, and they were right to do so. I don't agree with them, but they were right to do so. And so I'm hoping we can carry that into this year and have an election, which lets members decide what kind of union do they want to have, and let them experience that kind of union so that they can learn through their own experience.
Will you both run again?
We are going to run again, but yeah. I'm really hoping other people run as well and run on their vision of how the union should be, and we get to see what will happen and what people really want, you know? So it's not going to be one united, like, oh, everyone's going to go one way versus the other. But at least democracy is the best we have to deciding what 130 or 150 workers collectively are deciding they want for their union. So that is something we both hope to see. And if they vote for not us as leaders, but a different leadership, we're going to do our work as workers. Mm-hmm. We're going to continue to be revolutionaries. We're going to continue to say what we're going to say. We're not going to try to undermine the new leadership, but we're not going to not speak what we believe in there at the workplace. But definitely let them run the union, you know, and run that as the building reps, as it says in the little
thing. Well, I'll still participate in the UBC.
Yeah, so will I. But, you know, I'm not, I do think they have to get their chance to kind of do it their way.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure.
But we're going to speak our minds and then be like, okay, well, I said my piece, you know, go do my thing. And so that's what I hope. I hope we get that I hope our staff gets that option. But the most important thing for me is my work with Greg, and the common work we have. Yeah. Because the most important thing that could come of that is, in my mind, a set of socialists who see themselves as trying to build a socialist cell in that workplace. Mm-hmm. I think he should just give up on that whole DSA thing. I think it's a waste of time. But I do believe that committing to that is something that would...
TSA, Democratic
Socialist. DSA, right, yeah. Yes. And I do believe committing to that project, of whether it be a Marxist study circle at our site, whether it be an organizing center for socialists at that site, that is something that's a worthy project to go on. It's very modest. It doesn't seem big. It's entirely small, but it is the most important thing we can do as socialists and revolutionaries.
What's it been like working together?
Well, it's good. I've learned a lot from Andy, and I think through our disagreements, I think we create a kind of very constructive tension. Mm-hmm. That's what it's going to be like organizing the working class. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about identity politics. Everybody's going to bring their own fucked up shit into mm-hmm. the room, and you're going to have to talk through it and figure it out. And like, mm-hmm. how are we going to work together? Because not working together is not really an option. Mm-hmm. If we want to win, we're going to need as many people as possible. We're going to need the kind of, you know, ultras and trots and all the little factions in the workplace, the nitty gritty, you know, it's about gaining power and gaining power for all the workers and distributing that power. And so I really think that, Andy has taught me to place my goals first and think strategically, as I talked about with reading Marx and Lenin. It's not something I do. I'm very impulsive and kind of have a more kind of perceptional based way of thinking. Intuitively, I'm an intuitive thinker and ENFP, right? Second lowest earner on the Myers-Briggs scale.
Oh, I'm not familiar with
that. Well, I'm in the right district for the second lowest earner. No, it's gospel. It's like astrology for people people who drive Teslas. So anyway, I think that we create a good tension. I think Andy's learning a lot from me too, which is good. I need the confidence as a new teacher that I can actually get through to somebody. And if you reach a student like Andy, then you know you're doing something because he's stubborn. Some might even say bullheaded, which is very useful in jiu-jitsu, but when you're trying to reach somebody, it can be harder. So right now I would say the distribution of learning is I'm learning 70%, he's learning 30%. But in the working class, when you have kind of mutual... No, I mean, meaning like he's doing most of the teaching still to me in this partnership.
I see.
But in the working class, you're getting something out of a relationship. You're learning something from it. It's fertile and it's something to celebrate. And I think that's the kind of work that we got to be doing. You know, yeah, that's it for, yeah.
And Dean, what about your experience?
It has really been Darylin has been my lifeline for being in that site for the 20 years I've been in there. You know, she's been the person who has been the and Kathleen Cecil also was, but she passed away. And you know, she's been the person who I've always counted on as being able to go to when I'm frustrated or whatever. You know, she considers herself a socialist. But she knows she doesn't read theory and she doesn't really, she knows that she came to that notion in a very different way. And I don't see her as somebody who would want to join me in that project of building a Marxist socialist cell, reading Lenin, reading Trotsky, reading here history, Gramsci, Stalin, maybe whoever, Mao, right? And trying to wed that with our work. Because I do think that's what revolutionaries will need to do, is they need to be what Gramsci called organic intellectuals, people who are bound up in the workplace and are bound up through the theory of revolution, you know, which means they read about history and they read about politics.
It's like Che Guevara would make his, I've said this.
Possibly, yeah, yeah. I mean,
they had to read as well, both sides holding an arm.
Yeah, and so I feel like finally with Greg, I've found somebody who wants to do that work from the bottom, just like Darylin's committed to and I'm committed to do, but wants to do it as a conscious revolutionary and figure out how to weld theory and practice together. And I don't think you can do it on your own. It has been a big learning experience for me in terms of learning how to work with somebody else in a real way, because my experience in the ISO was very much like, we don't know how to handle differences within the revolutionary tradition. Mm-hmm. And I think working with Greg is teaching me about how to do that. And having somebody else to talk about this project with, so it's been invaluable. It's been, it's like you reach the end of the desert and you think you're dying of thirst and you're gonna really plop down and die. And Greg was like finding a person who had a cup of water and be like, all right, we can go a little bit farther. That's it.
So I wanted to say about how we found each other in this way was really funny. I was very frustrated and I don't remember about what. And I came up to Andy in the hallway about 3 months into my teaching career, early 2017. And I said to him something like, all we're doing is triage. All we're doing is putting our fingers in the holes in the levee, and there's a new hole every day. This is pointless if we're not fighting for revolution, if we're not fighting for justice. And I didn't know Andy's politics at this time. It was very strange. Mm. I don't think I knew your politics at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know what I expected you to say.
Right.
But I was just freaking out, and he had this face that was like, I will not bullshit you. And I just sensed that, and I unleashed this torrent of frustration with him. Probably something was going on with a student who was having a rough time. And Andy was like, I agree. And then you said, do you want to talk about this more?
Mm-hmm.
And there was just he chance.
Takes things seriously. Like
yes, he takes them seriously, and he says, show up and do the thing that you said you would do. That's what a revolutionary does. And yep. I can't be flaky or casual about this project because we're not. There's no time. There's no time to fuck around.
Yep.
And if you're fucking around, the person who's a little less committed than you is going to fuck around too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a waterfall of failure.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was just chance, really. I don't think I really knew your politics. I mm-hmm. knew that you. I saw you talking to Matt mm-hmm. and Darylin. Oh, I shouldn't say Matt. Mm-hmm. And so I knew that you were involved in union stuff, but I just didn't know who he was because he looks like a jock, you know? He's from somewhere in the Midwest. He's strong. He takes care of himself. Like, those are things that I don't know anything about. And so I took a risk, and it paid off. Through that, we found that, you know, we have the same priority. And we want justice. We want justice for our students and for ourselves as workers and our learning community, whatever fuzzy word they want to have for it. So then we started our project of struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is the key. And just rant is my moral here is that try ranting about the conditions that you work in, and maybe someone will agree with you.
So the next strike?
Well, we hope it comes out of this San Francisco contract round. We have a lot of work to do.
Yeah.
I think it's going to require a few schools who really are determined to strike to push our union leadership, which is not going to want to strike. It's 2020. Everything's going to be after the elections. It's going to be about Donald Trump and defeating Trump. Everything's going to be subordinated to that. Come August and September and October of 2020, which is when our contract will be, like, that's when we'll be returning to work and our contract will be over. But nevertheless, that's what we have to try to do.
And that was true of Oakland too, and I'm sure in LA. But, you know, Oakland High teachers organized a walkout. Oakland Tech teachers followed suit. Maybe I got that reversed. Skyline went out. They got student buy-in. They got 97% of their building to agree. They told the principal that it was going to happen. One principal was supportive. The other one wasn't. Doesn't matter. If you get 97% of your building, you're going to get the fuck out there on the street.
The rule is don't wait for your union leadership to organize your strike.
Do not.
You start it on your own, and you find school allies who want to join you. Because if you wait for the leadership, they're not going to do it.
Okay.
Well, they have to follow. They're worried about looking bad.
Right. Yep.
Thank you.
Thanks, Greg.
Both.
Hey, thank you, Andy.
Comrade. Nice job, Eduardo.
Thank you for both sharing the second part.
Mm-hmm.
This concludes our episode. Then I really learned a lot. It was fascinating, especially the struggle working. I just imagine what it's like working.
Yeah.
I remember the differences at work. Yeah.
All right. Do we know what we're doing next week?
We don't.
Do you have any ideas for what our episode could be next week?
We used to know what we were doing every week.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Sometimes we come up with ideas right here.
You should do the whole Epstein thing.
Jeffrey Epstein,
yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
We put that on the list as one thing. So that's possible.
I might be one.
If nothing comes up, that's
really
like,
depressing.
Yeah. And there's been these shootings.
The mass shootings. You should. And gun control. Yeah,
we did an episode on that. We can come up with it again.
Oh, I didn't listen to that one.
You got to go listen to that one.
I'm going to listen to it on the car home.
Yeah. And we invite our listeners and viewers to go to our Identity Politics episode because it was mentioned a lot.
Yeah. So we'll put Identity Politics one on
Yeah. All right.
So, as well as your previous interview. So we'll put that on the thing. So.
All right. Thank you. You can find us on any of our 5 social media platforms on YouTube, iTunes Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and BitChute. Please subscribe, rate, review, and best of all, share with your community, and we'll catch you next
time. And we always want your comments.
Yes.
Yes.
I don't. You guys can have them.
Yes. All right. See you next week. Ciao. Thanks a lot.
Welcome to What's Left, a weekly political discussion challenging the mainstream left.
Perfect.
That was awesome. That was the best.